At this time, help me welcome our speaker tonight, who is Shannon. He's from the Problem Solved Group in New York City.
Hello, everybody. My name is Shannon, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm like psyched to be here. It's funny how delusional you are in the beginning. I was here about a year ago. My sponsor spoke here, and a couple of us rode up in a car. And I want to thank my friend Joey for coming out. He brought some of his friends. And I was telling Joe probably, a couple weeks ago, I'm like, you got to come to this meeting. There's like 300-400 people. I mean, it's like, it's huge. It's standing room all. I mean, you know, 40-50, same thing. But, you know, it's seriously, it's just so funny. But I got to tell you, the energy in this room when I come in here, the way that I'm welcomed here, and the way that I've been here twice, and it feels like 3,000 people are in this room. The lights are on here. That's a no-brainer. The lights are on in this room. I love coming here. I got up here about an hour ago, and I met a few of you guys down at the diner down there, and had some pancakes. And and you know, it's ironic too because they're slick about it too. I didn't know that you guys paid for the guest or whatever the hell I am here, but so I ordered pancakes, and then she tells me afterwards. I'm like, oh damn, but they were good. They were good. So. You know, I went and spent some quiet time in one of your back rooms here, and I was talking to my sponsor on the way up here just to get a reality check and, you know, keep my feet on the ground. And I've come to realize that, you know, what I'm doing here tonight when I speak to you guys, you know, on the mic, or it's no different than when I make coffee. It's no different when I go into a detox center or I go into a jail or I go into a psych center. Or I'm just speaking at my home group, or I go to area. I'm the GSR for my home group. You know, I go there and try to be the voice of my group. And, I'm not up here tonight because I'm, better than anybody else. Or it's just another service gig in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's really what's kept me sober. I got to tell you, I drove up here by myself. I came up here today. I jumped in my car, filled it up with gas, and threw on some relaxing Metallica music and drove up 70. Yeah, there's one of you. What's up, dude? And then I turned the radio off about 50 miles out of here, and I got that warm, fuzzy feeling shoot up my spine. I thought about here. Sarah's not here tonight. I understand she had a slight back problem. But, you know, when Sarah asked me to come up here and speak for you guys tonight, I looked up at the sky, you know, tonight, and I said, thank you, God. Thank you for keeping me sober another day. And this is one of the tools that's necessary for a guy like me to stay sober, is to serve you. And that's why I'm here today. I, when I walked in the door, I met a new guy. I'm not sure how many other new people are in the room tonight. But I got to tell you, my main purpose, anytime I show up for AA, it's my primary purpose. It's to, A, of course, default, stay sober. But the byproduct, the only way that I'm able to stay sober is by practicing, you know, the three sides of the triangle, the service, unity, and recovery. That's the deal for me. And before I commence on my little journey here in Shannon, I got to tell you, how many people in here spend quiet time in the morning before they start their day? I just want to see a raise of hands. I figured I'd see a lot in this group. I think it was like last Wednesday or Thursday. I was spending some quiet time. I was meditating, you know, and I was thinking about the 24 hours ahead and how could I be of use. And it's amazing. I was sitting in my chair and I actually had some sage. I had some sage lit, you know, and it was nice and quiet. And I had to go to work that day, and I just kind of like melted back in my chair, and I concentrated on my breathing, and, you know, I thought about what's going to be my, you know, how can I help the man who's still sick? How can I help the man? And sometimes that's just by not being a jerk, you know, but, you know what I mean? Really, I mean, I do a nightly review, and sometimes I look at that question, I'm like, man, I didn't do a detox commitment tonight, but I didn't flip anybody off in traffic, so, you know what I mean? So sometimes it's just not being a jerk, you know, where I'm able to help the man who's still sick. And anyway, so I'm sitting in my chair, and I'm really getting it, man. I'm like, you know, I'm starting to become one with the universe, and my breathing is like calmed. All the outside noise is calmed down. I'm starting to, like, you know, the ebbs and flows of the universe are starting to flow through my living room, and I can smell the sage, and I become one with God and the universe. And I started thinking about my wedding. And it was, I got to tell you, it almost brought a tear to my eye. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, my wedding that's coming up, and you know, I wanted my sponsor to be there, and I was probably going to ask my stepfather to be my best man, you know, and this is the guy who I didn't talk to for many years because of my illness and, you know, the harms that I had caused, and, you know, and I'm picturing, like, where it's going to be, how it's going to be, and, like, all the family members are going to be there, and there's going to be people from AA, and it's just going to be so awesome, and I'm starting to really, I can see it all, and I'm, like, getting really emotional, and then the sixth sense, you guys familiar with that, the sixth sense? That voice kicked in just as I was starting to go there, and the voice said, "Hey, Shannon, maybe you should get a girlfriend first." can anybody relate to that? I mean, no, really. That's how I think. I know. Nicole's over here like, "I didn't even know we had a girlfriend." I'm like, "Oh my." But that's how I think, you know what I mean? It's just so funny, and it's just, but I swear, I had to tell that story because it's so true. It's like, I mean, this is the problem, you know, and not that that's a bad thing. I mean, it was actually comical. I mean, the voice came up, and it was like, "Dude, you don't even have a girlfriend." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, that's right. All right, never mind the wedding and the best man and all that stuff." But, and I went about my day. So, if anybody can relate to that, you're in trouble. No, but it's, I'd like to say, you know, that's one of the gifts. I got to be real upfront with you. Probably one of the biggest gifts that I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous is to be able to laugh about that voice. Because that voice almost convinced me to take my life. You know, I got to a dark spot in my life, and I'm sure you guys can really relate to that. Where, you know, I'm going to get to it, but. I'm really no different than anybody else. I don't have a classic story. I don't have a unique story. I'm the same guy that probably a lot of people in this room, and every time I say it, whether it's in a detox psych center or up here in Quakertown or wherever it may be, I'm the guy that just didn't fit. You know, I'm as a kid, you know, as 5-6 years old, I truly believe that my alcoholism started long before I picked up a drink of alcohol. I had a normal childhood, you know, for the most part. I really didn't, it wasn't anything real dramatic. But it was up here. It was up here in my head. I just never really fit. You know, like I just always felt too skinny or, you know, too pale or too, I wasn't muscular and athletic like the other boys in school were. And I wasn't, you know, I just didn't really fit in that well. I just wasn't really, I was always colliding with everybody. And like, I don't know. It just seemed like other people in the world could like, I don't know, they could just mingled with each other better than I did. I just never really meshed with the human race. And that's at 5-6 years old. I mean, at 5 years old, I was comparing my parents' house to my neighbor's parents' house, going, "Hey, how come we don't have pink shutters? And, you know, or why don't we have this? Or how come this?" And I had no idea for the longest time that that was a spiritual malady at 5 years old. You know, I was talking the other day, actually, John, you were there when we were in the big book study. We were reading more about alcoholism, and, you know, and I love it. It talks a lot about the thought, you know, that precedes the, you know, and that same thought is the thought that I've had with me since I was born. You know, I'm different. I'm less than. I mean, you ever hear somebody use the term like a hole in your soul? I mean, you know what I've come to find out now that I've been sober for a while and I've kind of done the deal and I've had a spiritual experience as a result of doing the triangle, circle and triangle. And I've come to realize that hole in my soul, that wasn't even real. It was an imaginary hole that my ego dug. That's amazing. And I heard my sponsor say it one time at a meeting, and he actually said those words. I'm like, damn, he's right. Same thing with my fears. Same thing with my resentments. You know, all that stuff. I mean, I jump around a lot. A, because I just, you know, when the spirit's in me, I'm just like all over the place. But B, I have ADD. So get that out of the way. So I don't fit well, and you know, I'm not the high school quarterback type. I'm not really involved in a lot of school sporting activities and football. And you know, while all my classmates were, you know, in chess club and Future Farmers of America, and did they have that here? By the way, every time I say that, I ask people, have you ever heard of that FFA? Did they have that here?
No.
Cool. All right, because I'm not originally from New York City. I'm originally from Rochester, New York, upstate. What's that all about? I like Rochester. You know, but I just didn't fit. I didn't like me. I didn't know that I didn't like me. I just know that I didn't, I kind of felt weird. I just, I'd go to school and I didn't, you know, all the kids after school were planning what they were going to do that Friday. We're going to go to the high school dance and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And I just couldn't picture myself doing stuff like that. I just didn't really feel like I was worthy of doing stuff like that. And, you know, when other kids were excelling in school and they were getting their, you know, their pictures taken in the yearbook and, you know, most likely to succeed. And you'd see, you know, John and Amy, you know, holding hands, walking down the hallway. And I didn't really ever do that stuff. I don't know why. I do now. But I didn't then. I just didn't really stack up. You know, I don't know. I was thinking about like in the fifth and sixth grade, you know, just before you start to get into high school. And this is when, you know, life's getting serious where, you know, my friends are getting girlfriends and they're starting to, you know, go to dances and, you know, Chicago and Air Supply are like the slow songs back then. And, you know, and I used to remember they'd plan it out and I wanted to go so bad. I wanted to go to that dance and I wanted to do what they were doing. And I couldn't do it. I'd go home and think about it and go, ah, whatever, who cares? You know, I'll go next year. And then I remember one time I actually went to a dance. Isn't it funny? You hear alcoholic story. I mean, even my grand sponsor spoke here a few years ago, and he talks about the high school dance. It's so funny. I think we've all had that high school dance. But I had the high school dance, too, and I remember going there, and everyone's out there kind of like this. It was like a, you know, a bigger room than this, like a gymnasium, and everyone's out there dancing and having fun. And, you know, and I'd sit there thinking, man, I just want to go walk right up to, and her name was Amy, and I wanted to, you know, Amy and I had big plans when I was in school. You know, I used to stare at the back of her head in the sixth grade, and I'd think about, you know, I'm like, should we have two dogs and one cat, or one cat and two dogs, and, you know, I'll probably have a pickup, and she'll have a caravan, and, you know, we'll get that fence, and we'll get, you know, the white picket fence, and we'll get the house up on the hill, and it's going to be great, And Amy and I were going to do some pretty, you know, extravagant things in life. And Amy didn't know this, but, you know, I didn't. That's all that really mattered. And I'll never forget, I had my first spiritual experience in school, and it was in the seventh grade. My friend Brian and I were passing a note back and forth, and he asked me a question. He said, if you were to go, you know, I know you don't go to those stupid dances and stuff, but if you were to go this Friday, who would you go with? Now, you guys already know the answer to that. I would go with Amy, you know, the love of my life. And I wrote it on a piece of paper. I said, well, I'd go with Amy, of course. That's a no-brainer. And so the class ended, you know, the bell rang, and everybody went to their next class. And I remember I was shuffling my books together. And I can remember like it was yesterday, and I was gathering all my stuff up and getting ready to go to the next class. And just as I look up, Amy's walking towards me. And as she's walking towards me, I look down at her hand, and she's got that note that I passed to Brian in her hand. Yeah. And you know, I'm a loser inside. That's the way I feel, and I feel less than. And, you know, she's walking down this aisle, and it's like 5,500-watt light bulbs were shining on me. I'm sweating. I'm like, oh, no. And I saw the note, and I was going to be ruined. I was just going to be, she was going to laugh at me and probably spit on me. And, you know, because that's the way I've always felt. You know, that's the way I hated myself. And she walked up to me, and she said, "What did you write this? To Brian on the note, something about you, the crazy stuff about you want to go to the dance." I'm like, well, you know, we're just messing around. It's no big deal. And she's like, oh, that's too bad because I'd love to go with you. You know, and I had my first spiritual experience, you know, when you know, but another human being, you know, I mean, because I've always felt less than. I was always like a shell of a human being, and I never thought that I was going to have a girl, and I never thought that I was going to be able to do the things that other people did. And Amy said she'd love to go to the dance with me, and I couldn't wait. I ran home, and I was like, I was just so excited. Like, for the first time in my life, I was going to be like you guys, be like the normal people. And I remember going to the dance that night, and I showed up, and she was there, and the music was playing. And she's out there with her girlfriends dancing, and she's kind of giving me the, come on out and dance. And I couldn't dance. I was afraid. Of course. I was that guy holding up the wall. I'm like, yeah, 1 minute here. I got to nurse an old ping pong injury. I got to, you know, I'll be out there in a minute, you know, and next song would come, and she, you know, so finally the slow song came, and she said, come on, it's time. It was probably, you know, like I said, it was Air Supply or Chicago or something like that. And she said, why don't you come out and let's do this. Let's, you know, I'd like to have a slow dance with you. She grabbed a hold of my hand. And now remember how I said I had all these plans and like big things. Here's my opportunity right here. This is the gateway to like the picket fence and, you know, the chainsaw and the weed whacker, and we're going to have a family and it's going to be great. And I backed down. I pulled away and I said, I can't right now. I don't feel too well. And because I was afraid, guys, that's what it really boils down to. And my whole moral of my life has been fear. I mean, I love what our book says. It's the fabric of our existence shot through and through. I mean, think about that. The fabric of your existence. I mean, fear. And I was so afraid. I mean, I wanted to dance with her. I wanted to get out there and like break dance and like, you know, and just, and I couldn't. So Amy and I are dating for a couple weeks, and this is where, or a couple months, I'm sorry, we're not holding hands. Everybody else is meeting by the brownie house and kissing their girlfriends behind the tree and doing what, you know, adolescents do. I would tell you that I did. We'd be in gym class, and they're like, what? God, you know, the guys be like, yeah, what's going on with you and Amy? I'm like, oh, yeah, we're hot and heavy. We're serious. And the reality was that I hadn't even grabbed her hand yet. You know, the stories that I told, you'd think I was like, but no, I did. The truth of the matter was, is I didn't even grab her hand. I was too afraid. I was scared. I was afraid I was going to maybe squeeze it too hard, or she was going to reject me, or who knows? I mean, if anybody in this room can, you know, identify with the spiritual malady, you know what I'm talking about, you know. And about 2 months into dating Amy, if that's what you want to call it, she says to me, hey, we're going to the carnival this weekend. And remember, I'm not much of a social guy, and I wasn't really into it. But she said, but we're going to get a couple cases of beer. Would you like to, you know, pitch in? And I hadn't drank at this point, and I said, yeah. I ran home and robbed some of my dad's quarters out of his mason jar. I had to help out. And brought it back in. I pitched in. We got a couple cases of Stroh's beer. I still remember. Yeah. Whoa. All right. You know, I say that in New York City. They're like, nah. You know. You see it like OE or something. They're like, yeah, all right, 40. You know, but it was Stroh's. And, you know, so we got a couple cases of Stroh's. And, you know, and that's ironic. I'm going to be 42 years old in about 3 weeks. And I'm not bragging. But I don't even know what I had for dinner like 2 weeks ago or a week ago. But I remember exactly to a T what alcohol did for me that night. And I'm going to explain what it did. You know, we got up, we drove up. This was a suburb of Rochester, New York. It was like a hick town. And we're in the back of my buddy's 79 Monte Carlo. We're up on this, it's called Top of the World. And basically what it was just a hill and you could see far. And so we called it Top of the World. And I'll never forget, he started passing the beers around. And I remember cracking the first one down and the music was playing. And I chugged it down and it kind of burned, really. I mean, I didn't know what to expect. It wasn't like a whiskey burn. It was like slamming ginger ale. You know what I mean? I was just kind of like, whoa, that's different. And, you know, I remember throwing the bottle, I remember throwing the bottle out his window. And already they're making comments. They're like, wow, you know, that was quick. You want another one? I said, yeah, absolutely. Of course I do. And about halfway down the second beer, something magical happened to me. You know, our co-founder, Bill W., called it, you know, the magic elixir. And even as I sit here tonight before you, and I mention, I get goosebumps every time I tell my story. In the doctor's opinion, it says, Silky talks about, he said, people drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I did. About halfway down that second Stroh's beer, all of a sudden, Robert Plant sounded just a little bit better on the radio. You know, I asked Kevin to turn up the radio, and I'll never forget, I looked down at the seat, and there was like a 12, 15-inch gap between Amy and I, and I looked down, I'm thinking, what the hell, why is she so far away from me? And I slid right up next to Amy, you know, the love of my life, the one who I never held her hand, the one I never really showed any affection towards, and I put a lip lock on her like Jenna Jameson. I don't know, I mean, it's the only name I could think of. I don't know where the hell that even came from, but it works. Are you recording this? No, but you know what I mean? I mean, that's what alcohol did for me, man. I remember kissing her and holding her hand, and I hugged her. And, like, I wanted – and I vividly remember thinking the next thing that came to my mind was, why aren't we down at the carnival? You know, why are we stuck up here on this back road in the middle? When I get alcohol in me, I get this feeling. I just get this feeling like I just want to, like, I have to do stuff. You know what I mean? And that's what alcohol did for me is, you know, all of a sudden that shy, introverted guy that really didn't like himself too much and never really fit in wanted to fit in. wanted to go down to that carnival and like high five the high school quarterback, and like I remember throwing darts at balloons and winning Amy these stuffed toys and animals and like the, you know, I mean, you guys had carnivals here, right? Back when you were, all right, cool. So, no, but remember like back, you know, the carny guys, you know, they'd be playing, there'd be different rock and roll playing in different tents and I like it with like AC/DC and like Metallica, you know, and Van Halen. And I could just hear all this music coming from different places and lights and sounds and, oh man. And I had Amy. You know, and my buddy, my good friend Kevin, and I wasn't a loser anymore. I was somebody. You know, I don't know if I made a conscious or a subconscious decision that night, but whatever decision it was, I made a decision that night that whatever this was that I had found, I will never let go. Never. Never. And I almost died because of it. That's the God's honest truth. I got to a point, where, you know, obviously we'll get there towards the end of my story, but I got to a point where, you know, that magic stuff stopped working. That sucks. You know, and if you're a coward like me and you can't face life, you know, I usually think about checking out. You know, and that's what ended up happening. But I loved it. And it's ironic. I hear people tell their story and they say, and then I didn't drink again until college. Or, you know, and then, you know, it was like 6 months later, I was on a camping trip and I drank the next day. I drank the next day. I really did. I'm one of those guys that their parents had a stocked bar. And I remember going home that night, and I made a beeline right towards the basement. And I went down in there, and I started mixing all this stuff in this, like, igloo. And it was funny, too, because it was like cream de menthe and peach schnapps and vodka. And every time I say that, I get the same exact response. And I, you know, some of this blue stuff and some of this stuff over here, you know, and I'm throwing all this stuff in, because it's ironic that I don't care what it tastes like. I loved what it did for me. I loved what it did for me. And I actually started thinking that night when I went to bed. Now it's funny, because I remember going to bed that night, and I'm thinking, you know, tomorrow, because now I've kissed Amy, I've, you know, I've groped her all over the place. You know, I'm like, she's going to expect this the next day. I'm going to have to walk her to her boss and kiss her again. And I can't do that unless I have this stuff with me. That's how I'm wired. That's my whole life has always been like that. You know, our book talks about, you know, moral and philosophical convictions galore. And, you know, I'm that guy that's like, you know, all right, you know, I don't need that stuff. I'm going to go kiss her right now. I'm going to prove. Nope. I can't. I'm not that guy. I needed alcohol. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself for a long time. Really, and thank God I found Alcoholics Anonymous and I found a power that actually does the same thing, but it's real. It's not fool's gold. It works through and through. You know, and I'm going through high school drinking pretty much, I don't want to say daily, but I'm drinking quite a bit. I like what it did for me, and I got this girl, and, you know, and I didn't feel empty anymore. And, you know, obviously the liquor cabinet only lasts for so long, so you got to start hanging out with older friends, and, you know, and obviously that came into play, and I'll never forget my... I turned 16 years old, and my principal called me in the office, and he said to me, Shannon, here's the deal. I'm not going to, you know, beat around the bush, but you've been drinking for quite a while now. We know about it. You're sweating vodka in gym class. It's no big secret. You got to make a decision. If you want to graduate from my school, you got to stop this. You can't drink during school out. You can't. It's not acceptable. And I, guys, without even a hesitation, without even, like, thinking about, well, you know, can you give me a couple weeks to think about it? You know, I said, see you later. And I quit, and I've never returned. I quit that day. I left. Because, like I said, I don't know if it was a conscious or a subconscious decision, but I made some type of a decision that whatever this was that I had found, this magic elixir, that nothing was going to stand in between me and it. Nothing. And I got home that night, and, you know, I walked in the house, and I saw my stepdad, and, you know, he was doing the old tapping the foot and leaning up against the doorway, and I'm like, oh, boy, you know, Principal Dutchess called him already. I'm like, yeah, what's up, Dad? And they said the same thing. They said, we know all of our liquor in the cabinet's pure water now, and they were right. You know, right, or I try, like, replacing, like, a, you know, $100 bottle of vodka with, like, Skol or something like that. Vodka's vodka, right? No. And, you know, they knew the game. They knew what was going on. And you know what? By then, I'm already hiding the stuff around the house. I'm hiding it up in, I used to have this crawl space in my bedroom. I'd pull back the old, the old pink insulation there, and I was hiding stuff there. And as a teenager, I'm already. It's boom. I took off quick with this stuff, really quick. And my parents told me that night that afternoon, my mom, of course, she's a nervous wreck, and she can't believe this is happening to her poor boy, and he's drinking and not doing so hot in school. And they said to me, you have to make a decision. We love you. We love you very much, and we're willing to, if you want to get help and at this stage, I don't see it as a problem. Let's not kid ourselves. If anybody here can relate, alcohol was actually my solution for a long time. And that's the way I looked at it, too, even back then. And I'm thinking, why would I want help? There's nothing wrong, and they told me, you got to make a decision. If you want to live in our house and stay under this roof, you got to stop. You got to stop drinking. And I moved out that night. Yeah, I know. Yep, I moved out that night. I didn't think about that. And I got to tell you guys, man, I don't know. Obviously it wouldn't have stopped me. I'm that real deal. I'm that real alcoholic. If you could have played my tape ahead and said, Shannon, this is the journey that alcohol is going to take you on. Are you sure? I would have anyway. That's just how I'm wired. But I had no idea that the journey that this booze was going to take me on. The psych centers and the detoxes and, the jails. And being homeless. I'm 16, 17 years old at the time, and I'm drinking a lot, and I'm already making decisions, that are later on in life are going to hurt me, like our book talks about, making decisions based on self, and mine was at the time was booze, and I think I told my dad to F off, and I left. I grabbed what little things I could, whatever I could take with me, and I left the home. I left my home, and I haven't returned since. And I didn't even know where I was going. I'm serious. That night, I didn't have like a game plan. All right, I'm going to leave and, I'll be able to stay at my cousin's house, or I'll be able to crash. I was just like staying wherever. Because I had to keep drinking. And this point in the game, I loved what it did for me. And I left, I left and I was staying on buddy's couches for a while. Or, I remember sleeping in my buddy's deer stand in the summertime. It's funny now when I look back on it, but it's pathetic. It's sad. It's definitely, I laugh at it. I slept in deer stands. And I slept in my buddy's van for like 2 months. But what happens, guys, is, if you're anything like me, you become a leech. And like I'm stealing their clothes when they're not home, and because I got no clean clothes to wear. And I'm stealing my buddy's socks and, taking what little change he has. He's trying to be a friend of mine and help me out. And I'm hurting him, and I'm stealing from him, and I'm eating food, and He's still living at home with his parents, living a normal life, and they're saying, I don't know who this Shannon kid is, but he's not allowed here anymore. And that was the story of my life. I would go from one couch to the next, from one van to the next backyard to the this, and I did that for a long time. And if you're anything like me, what happens is that can only last so long. the universe just doesn't work like that. And if you're anything like me, you end up breaking the law eventually. And that's what I started doing. I started robbing stuff and stealing and breaking into houses and robbing cars, stereos, or taking the change. It was like survival for me. And the whole time I'm doing this, all I'm thinking about is what's going to happen this Friday and what's going to happen Saturday at this party. And and it's sad. I look back and all my friends they're starting to do normal things like graduate and, go to college, and they're got their high school sweethearts, and they're doing, they're doing normal things. And I'm that guy that, 17, 18 years old, that's already been in jail. I haven't talked to my family in like a couple, probably a year, a good year, a year and a half. And, I'm drinking constantly. And, I think I've been in jail like 12 times. And, it was like a year here, 6 months there, 90 days, 30 days, 15 days, good time, probation. And I've been through the system like just so, and that's a byproduct of my behavior. It's a byproduct of my drinking. It's a byproduct of my alcoholism. And I by far did not live a normal life. And you know, I'm starting to go into rehabs now, and I'm only going into rehab so I can get out of jail. I still don't think that I got a problem. You know, the judges are telling me you got a problem. You know, everybody in your life's telling you got a problem. You've really got no friends. You've burned your life to the ground. You know what I mean? It's this endless cycle, and I'm just I started getting to a point where I'm pretty pathetic. You know, I'm pretty pathetic. I'm not going home for Christmas because I just don't know how to be a son. I'm more of like a shell of a human being. I'm that guy that's calling his mom on Mother's Day from a correctional facility to say Happy Mother's Day. You know, it's really sad. But I kept drinking. I didn't see really drinking as a problem. At this point I'm getting older, and my life's out of control. My life's out of control, and I've gone to a few rehabs, and I started, you know, and I've come into Alcoholics Anonymous pretty much every way possible. I mean, when I first got to AA, I'm in total, you know, denial. It's like, this is a joke. Look at these people, and I can't believe I'm here, but, you know, but my probation officer says I have to be in. That lasts, what, a week, 2 weeks, and I'm back out drinking again. Then there's another time I'll come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's still kind of a joke, but I kind of like being here because it's a place to kind of, you know, bum cigarettes and, you know, get some free coffee. And, you know, the meetings they had, like cake and donuts, were like my favorite places. And you, no, but really, I mean, you know, so, you know, and then that would last a month. And I'd disappear again. And I'd go back out there again. And then I got to tell you guys, one time I came at Alcoholics Anonymous about 7 years ago, 8 years ago, and I'd been in and out of AA a bunch of times, and it was a joke, and you know. But I came into AA, and I got it intellectually. I suffered just enough to sit down here and hang out with you guys for a while, and I started to sit around thinking maybe there's something wrong with me. Maybe there's something wrong with me, because all my friends that I had in high school are now like own businesses, and they have car payments and good credit, and they have their own home, and you know, they're married with their little Johnny's on his way, and you know, they're living normal lives. They're not in jail and rehabs and psych centers and detox. Okay, so maybe drinking does have a little something to do with this. Let me hang out here and see what you guys have to offer. Screw it. You know, because each time I come in AA, I suffered a little bit more. I suffered a little bit more. I suffered a little bit more. And I came in and I got it intellectually. I'll never forget that a guy sat down with me at a big book study. I started crying. I mean, he broke down the doctor's opinion like I've never heard it broken down before. You know, he talked about that physical allergy and that mental obsession, and I went, oh, my God. Oh, my God. That makes, back when I was 16 and I, oh, my God. I got it. I got it. I'm allergic to alcohol. I'm not like my normal man. And I started going around meetings, and, you know, I was like, I had the big book under one arm and, like, you know, the podium in my other arm. And, you know, I'm going around, like, standing on soapboxes telling you guys, hey, guys, you're allergic, and this is why. And, you know, no, I'm serious, man. Like, I think I even started, like, my own big book study, but we only did one chapter. But, you know, and I'm like, but God, it made sense to me. Like, this is why I continue to drink. You know, this is why. And because I'm, you know, I'm physically allergic, and the whole mental obsession, strange mental blank spots, peculiar mental. So I'm like, oh my God, this makes so much sense. And I think I stayed sober for 4 months, about four to 6 months. I stayed sober. And that was a big deal for me. And I drank again. I love what Bill says. Self-knowledge is not enough for a guy like me. We still haven't gotten to the whole crux of what's really wrong with a guy like me, that spiritual part. And I drank again. And now I'm drinking and I don't even want to drink. Now it's not magic anymore. Now it's not covering up feelings. Now it's not, I'm not getting that get up and want to go to town party feeling like my sponsor says anymore. I'm not, it's not making me fit. It's not, it's pathetic. It's pathetic. I'm drinking and I don't even want to drink. There was a few good times left, don't get me wrong. I mean, there was a couple of times where I'd come home and, you know, throw some back. And, you know, and this continued on and off and on and off, you know, into my 20s and into my 30s. And I'm drinking on and off. And now I know I'm an alcoholic. You know, now I don't really still know what's wrong with me, but I know that something's wrong with me. And I know that I shouldn't be doing this, and I can't stop. I can't stop. You know, I'd get a job for, you know, a couple months, and You know, it's funny. My friends and I always joke for my home group, but you know, we hear the new guys coming into AA, and they're like, they got like the month sober, and they're already planning out. All right, I'm gonna fix up my credit, and I'm gonna get that good union paying job, and I'm like, yeah, you can almost hear Eye of the Tiger playing in the background. You know, like the Eye of the Tiger. You know, because I used to do that, like dun dun dun. I would wake up and go, man, first thing tomorrow, I'm gonna stop abusing my girlfriend. I'm gonna stop lying to her. This drinking stuff is going to stop. I am serious. I'm going to go back to those AA. Matter of fact, I'm going to call that one guy. I really like him a lot. I respect him. He's, you know, he's well known in AA, and I might even ask him to be my sponsor. Woo. I think I'm going to first thing tomorrow. That's the story of my life. Yeah, first thing tomorrow, I'm going to, you know, and as you guys know, tomorrow never came, and the girl would leave me, and I'd lose the job. And, you know, and that continued on for many years. And you know, now I'm in my 30s, and that's going on. I can't hold a job that long, and I'm not much of a member of society, and I'm not going home for holidays, and I'm not much of a son, and I'm not a brother. I'm not a good tenant. I mean, Jesus, when I got to AA, I had a Time Warner, Con Ed, I mean, you know, child support. I mean, I had anything and everybody looking for me when I got here. Ooh, even imaginary, like, utility companies that my fear had built up. But, you know, and that's continuing on and on, guys. And I know I'm a drunk. I don't really know what a drunk is, but I know I'm kind of one of them. And I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. This was about 7 years ago, and I surrendered. I came in AA pretty broken. And I asked the guy to be my sponsor. And he said, well, what do you want to do to stay sober? I said, anything. He said, anything? And I said, anything. And he gave me a list of stuff to do, and, you know, I did most of them. And he asked me to get a home group, and this was up in Rochester. He asked me to get a home group, and he asked me to get 30 phone numbers. Like, 30 phone numbers, a home group, and a service position. And I'm like, you know, the home group was like, you know, just show up someplace that, you know, same time, and, you know, that's no big deal. Service, you know, sure, I'll throw away coffee cups or whatever. No, but 30 phone numbers, like, I couldn't even get one, you know. And I learned later on, obviously, that was the exercise to get out there and put your hand out there and meet guys. And, you know, but anyway, but I got them. I got the 30 phone numbers, and I got the home group, and I got the service, and I started to do the deal. And this is, guys, I really think that there's two types of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, me being one of them, and this is not a judgment. This is what I've seen is I think that people get Alcoholics Anonymous with their head, and then I think there's others that get it with their heart. And I had 7 years sober, I was sponsoring guys. I made it up to step 9. I had a home group. I was doing a little bit of service, and I did just enough in AA to drink again. I really believe that I got it, in, you know, better than the doctor's opinion intellectually the time before that. You know, like, I had done the best of my ability, you know, to do a four-step, and I sat down with a guy, and I shared it with him, and I thought I did good. I mean, I felt like, wow, I'm finally, you know, like, whew, I feel much better that, you know, the anvil's been pushed off my chest, and you know, we went through a few more steps, and he said, I want you to start working with others. And I said, absolutely, let's do this. You know, and I got an opportunity to sponsor a few guys, and that was it. And I stopped growing from there. You know, I love what our book, you know, our book talks about. I don't know if it's Fred or Jim, but one of the parts that he talks about, he made a beginning. And I got to tell you guys that this illness it's really powerful, and it's really patient. My ego is really powerful. It waited 7 years to snuff me again. It waited 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsor guys, doing service, having a home group. It tricked me again. And it convinced me that this time it wasn't going to burn me. That's the truth. And you know, I drank again. And I drank for 8 more months after that. And it was the worst 8 months of my life. You know, the party that my ego always... See, because here's what happens, guys. Our book talks about it the best. The book says it a lot better than I can. But for a guy like me, this is what happens is in AA, is A, I convince myself that I'm doing the whole deal. You know what I mean? And what happens is I love what it says. You know, it says we're not cured of this. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I used to quote that like a parrot in Alcoholics Anonymous, 6, 7, 5, 6, 7 years old, and I missed the most important part of that phrase. I was walking towards my grave and didn't even know it as I'm quoting sentences like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't even see it coming. And what happened, guys, is the same thing that happens time and time again for a guy like me, is the ego returns. And it convinces me that this time when I drink, Hugh Hefner's going to be there with all of his girlfriends. It's going to be in Rio de Janeiro, and there's going to be like bags of money, and it's going to be fun, and it's going to be awesome, and it's always going to be like that, Shannon. There's going to be no consequences. You're not going to end up in a psych center. You're not going to end up in a D. Even though you did the 947 other times, this time it's going to be different. And I laugh at that today, and I chuckle as well. The sad part of this is that if you're like me, if you're wired like I am, and you don't continue to do this deal, you'll believe that lie too. You'll believe that lie too. And that's what happened as I drank again. In my last 8 months of drinking, like I said, guys, it wasn't a party. You know, here's the thing. I was in Manhattan, and I was up on a rooftop lounge, one of the nice, really nice places. It was a corporate event for a company that I work for, and I had made a conscious decision that I was going to drink again, and it was going to be different. I remember I ordered a Tanqueray and tonic. I remember the bartender sliding. Now, this is after 7 years sober, speaking up at microphones, quoting from the book, sponsoring guys, doing AA. So I thought. And I said, yeah, I'll have a double Tanqueray tonic, please. And she slid it across the bar. And I remember sucking it back, and that feeling came in. And I remember looking out. I was like, I was overlooking Manhattan. And I'm not from Manhattan. I'm from, like, upstate. So this was, like, a big deal. I'm overlooking. I got my drink in my hand, and I'm like, this is going to be okay. You know, and I'm like, flicking my $100 tie and my nice sport coat and thinking this is going to be nice. I'm good. And within 2 weeks, I was holed up in my apartment in Brooklyn. With the door locked and the shades drawn, drinking the cheapest vodka known to man. The party, guys, that's the thing, is the party was over for me a long time ago, but for some reason I still fall victim to the lie that this time, maybe this time it'll be a party. And it wasn't. I drank for 8 months on a daily basis. I got to the point where I was having shakes at work. I'd never had shakes before, and I would run over to the liquor store. I worked down in the financial district of Manhattan. I'd run over to this liquor store, and I'd slam those, what are they, the little shooters? Is that what they're called? Like airplane bottles? I would slam like one of those down, like a thing of vodka or Captain Morgan's, whatever. I'd slam one of those down, and the shakes would stop. And I'd run back up and finish my work for the day. And I couldn't wait to get home because I would run home real quick, and I would grab the two bottles of cheap Mr. Boston 100-proof vodka, and I would run in my house. And I'd pour them in some orange juice, and I'd pour it in there and throw some ice in there, a straw, and I'd suck it down. I'd drink, like, the first, you know, it was a pretty tall glass. I would suck that down real fast and then go, oh, all right. And I'd turn on SportsCenter, and all right, I can breathe now. And it wasn't a party. And about 8 months later, I remember running home and I got those two same bottles of vodka, and I went up in my apartment, and I shut the door and threw the cell phone up and undressed, threw on some sweatpants and a T-shirt, and threw that vodka in that glass like I always do, and listened to it hit the, you know, fill up and put the orange juice in the straw in there. And I'm like, all right, here we go. And I remember sucking the first glass down, and I'm like, okay, what's going on here? I don't feel that. All right, so let me try it again. And about three of those glasses later, I'd realized something. That it wasn't working anymore. And I was in a lot of trouble. The thing that I fell head over heels in love with, you know, 20-some years back, it at least got me through the hard times, and at least got me to where I could breathe and kind of function and watch TV without freaking out. And, you know, if my phone went off, I wouldn't have a nervous, you know, it wasn't working anymore. And I said, maybe I'm just having a bad day. You know, I went to work the next day, and for the last week of my drinking, that feeling didn't come back, and I I sat on my couch one night, about three glasses into that vodka, and I said to myself, I got to die. I have to die. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I have to kill myself. I couldn't stand the effects produced by sobriety. I wanted to die. It wasn't washing away all of a sudden the pain of all the things that I had caused over the years. Faces were popping up, and I was drinking. I didn't want to drink, and I couldn't stop, but I still wanted to because I wanted to cover up a feeling. I thought, and it was like this vicious cycle, and it wouldn't work anymore. And so I started. I actually went on the internet. That's pathetic, but I actually went on the internet. Look, and I think I Googled least painful way to commit suicide. That's like when I first started here tonight, when I was talking with you guys, that the shift that's changed from that spiritual experience, from me joking about planning my wedding with a girl that I don't even have, to Googling how to take my life. And that's where it got me. That's where this illness brought me. Is it got me to a point where I wanted to check out. I wanted to commit. And I'm not really like a commit suicide type of guy. I'm a coward. I really am. I'm a coward. I see these guys that like swallow shotguns or put a pistol in their mouth and they do it. And I'm not that guy. But I was seriously contemplating it. I was seriously thinking I could swallow some pills. I started thinking I could call my doctor, get a prescription for something, powerful. And the next glass that I drink, I'll just eat 100. Actually, my friend just killed himself about 5 months ago. That's what he did. He did that same thing. He swallowed 100 Xanax, like 120 or something. They knew because the whole bottle was empty. He swallowed like 120 Xanax and washed it down with a bottle of Jack Daniels and never woke up. And that's what I wanted to do. And I think that's probably the saddest thing that I've seen in my own life and that I see in Alcoholics Anonymous, guys, is that I'm that guy that came in and out, and thought that he did the deal, thought that I did Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just doesn't work for a loser like me. And I think that's what happened to my friend Lance. I think he tried Alcoholics Anonymous. And even though on his death certificate it says, self-inflict suicide, whatever the hell it says, we that knew him close knew what he died from. And he died from untreated alcoholism. The very same thing that almost took me out. The very same thing that convinced me that the party's over, the magic stuff's not working anymore, you're pathetic, end your life. And that's all I kept hearing over and over again the last couple, month and a half, I'll say, of my drinking. And I got to tell you this, guys. Coming back into Alcoholics Anonymous after you've been sober for a while is very difficult. Because I'm coming back into Alcoholics Anonymous with the delusion that I've already done this. What's the point? Because the ego does a really good job of painting that picture when it comes back too. My grand sponsor talks about it a lot. Those guys that have been out, stayed sober 20, 25, 30 years, most of them you never see again. And when I told my sponsor, he said, "Well, how long did you have?" I said, "Well, I had 7 years, which is a decent, decent chunk of change staying away from a drink and thinking you're doing the deal." And he said to me, "Thank God you came back when you did." I'm like, "What? Really?" And I know what he means by that today. It was hard for me to come back, guys. I came back in here and I'm Mr. I know the book and I know this. And I'm actually telling my sponsor this. I'm like, "Yeah, I ran into him in Brooklyn. He was doing a big book workshop and I was hurting really bad. And obviously, I didn't end my life. I'm here. And, I used to hear you guys talk about this gift of desperation. And I never knew what it meant until I experienced it. And I remember looking at this bottle, and I smashed it up against my cupboard, this bottle of vodka. It's still there. I smashed my bottle of vodka. I grabbed my phone. And I started dialing this guy that I knew from Alcoholics Anonymous from a long time ago. And he hooked me up with a guy who hooked me up with a guy who said, "All right, go over to this big book meeting on Tuesday, and this guy's going to be here," and blah, 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 blah. And so I went over there, and I heard this guy talking. And the lights were on in his life, and I started crying, and I went up to him, and I brought him outside, and I said, "Listen, here's the deal. I'm hurting real bad. I'm thinking about committing suicide. I need your help. Please sponsor me." And he says, "Well, let's go outside for a second. We'll have a little talk." And he did what it talks about in working with others. He kind of, interviewed me, to make sure that I was the real deal. And he asked me a few questions, and he said, "Yeah, you're in a lot of trouble." I said, "Yeah, I did this, and I kind of sponsored guys, and I kind of did the steps, and 7 years, and I want to die, and I'm freaking out, man. I don't know what to do, and will you help me, please? And what do you suggest?" And he kind of let me rant for a minute, and he said, sounds like you better find a bigger God. And I didn't really know what he meant, but I believed him. And, you know, I went home, and this is a guy, I went home that night, and he had me do an exercise out of the book, but it's something a little bit differently. It's just to have a deeper spiritual experience. And I'll never forget, he had me do a second step exercise. And now this is a guy that's an Alcoholics Anonymous that's quoting, that's telling you that, you know, quoting the sunlight of the Spirit, I can feel the power of God, and I don't even know that the lights are off in my own life. That's how powerful this illness is. That's how delusional I can get. You know, I'm in AA years sober, away from a drink, and I'm telling you guys that I can feel God in my heart right now as I'm talking to you, man. And I'm so far away from God, it's pathetic. How do I know this? Well, he had me go home that night. I'm sorry, not that night. He had me do a few things, but he had me do a second step exercise. And the second step is, you know, obviously came to believe that a power of the greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So the exercise was, there was a whole bunch of questions on this piece of paper, and he said, I want you to, and one of the questions actually is, just turn this piece of paper over, it's blank, and write on there what you know about God. And my mind went blank. And I started crying. I was all by myself in my apartment. And I had realized for the first time in my life that I didn't know a goddamn thing about God. Nothing. I couldn't even write one word, and I called him up crying really bad and sad and hurt and devastated, and I said, I feel worthless. I don't feel worthy. I'm confused. What do I do? I don't even know who God is. And he goes, okay, talk to me tomorrow. You know, and that's how the journey started is, you know, my sponsor says to me all the time, like I'll say, man, I got a lot to learn, and he says it to me all the time. He says, no, my friend, you got a lot to unlearn. And that was one of the things that I really got was I had a lot to unlearn, you know. And one of the things I learned, unlearned, is that I didn't know who God was. I didn't even have a misconception of God or a conception. I had no clue who he was. And I started on this journey, and he had me start going into detox centers. And he's got me, you know, going to this home group, and I'm having a spiritual experience. We sat down, and I did a written four-step. I was done in, I think, like 3 weeks. He came to my house on St. Paddy's Day, go figure. And I think it was about 8 hours. And we turned the phone off, and we went through the fifth step of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I dumped it all out, and I let it all out, and I, for the first time in my life, I connected with another human being. You know, and we continued on this process, and he continued to have me do spiritual exercises that were kind of against my grain, but I did them anyway. And I started to go out and make amends. I started to go out and look people in the face that I had harmed through all my years and all my wreckage and all my carnage, and I started to make amends, and I started to look across from another man or a woman that I had caused harm to, and God gave me the strength and the power to go there and say, I wronged you. And guys, what ended up happening is through this series of events and everything is I'm going through the steps for the first time in my life, and what ended up happening is I had a spiritual experience. I didn't even see it coming. I came in Alcoholics Anonymous because I couldn't stop drinking, and I was pathetic, and I wanted to die. And I had no idea that this was going to happen. I mean, I had no idea that the life that I've been given today was going to... Because I got to be honest with you guys. You know how it says beyond your wildest dreams? I mean, my wildest dreams, if you would have came to me when I had a week sober and said, you know, what do you want in life? I would have been like, a Mercedes. I mean, that's... And I have one out in the parking lot, and it breaks down like every 2 months. So I would have sold myself really short. You know, but really, that's the story of my life. You know, I started hanging out with my sponsor, and I came up here, and I started going to meetings, and man, I guess I just got to a point where I'd suffered so bad that I surrendered to the Alcoholics Anonymous. I surrendered to you guys. I surrendered to this deal. I had no more yeah buts, no more excuses, and no more lies, and no more reasons why I was so pathetic. I found that bigger God. I found that bigger God. And because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a home group and working with guys, and I go to a detox commitment a couple times a week, and I go to Rikers Island, Bellevue. I go in there. I love, man, the more barbed wire and puke, the better. I'm serious, man. I love going into those places. I love jails and institutions. I don't know if it's called H&I here. I don't know if it's called the same hospitals and institutions. I sign up for that every chance I get. I sign up for hospitals and institutions every chance I get. I love going into the places that I was in and letting guys know you don't have to suffer anymore. You don't have to suffer anymore. And you know what's ironic is probably I've talked with, I don't know, 100 guys in detox over the past few months, and not one of them's called me. And I was talking to my sponsor about that. I'm like, man, you know, this is going on. I'm going to all these detoxes and hospitals. And, geez, I don't know what to do. And, you know, nobody's staying sober. And he goes, you are. And I keep showing up. And I keep doing this deal. And I got to tell you guys something. I'm going to end with this. I had 9 days sober, 9, 10 days sober. And I remember walking down the street and I call up my sponsor, Wigan. You know, the illness had me. The ego had returned. I was, that spiritual malady was just in flames. And actually, I got two things. Something just came to mind. I got a text from my mother a week ago. And it came out of nowhere. It was on a Sunday, last Sunday. It came out of nowhere. She said, you know, I've been thinking a lot about you lately. And I'm like, uh-oh, where's this going? How much, I thought I made financial amends. And she said, you know, I was in church today, and the father was saying something about forgiveness or something. She goes, you know, you've been through a lot in life, and I don't know how to say this, Shannon, but, you know, when you made amends to me and these little checks that you send for $50 here, $25 there, $100 there, she's like, that's the power of God. I love you. You're my son, and I'm very proud of you, and I hope you keep doing whatever it is you're doing there in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a guy who hadn't been home in 4 Christmases, who was afraid to face his mother, who couldn't be a son, who said she's proud of me and she loves me. You know, that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had 9 days sober, and I called my sponsor up, and I said, I'm freaking out, man, and my girl left me, and I think I'm going to lose my job, and, you know, I'm rattling up all this stuff, and Time Warner's looking for me, I'm going to get evicted, and I don't know what I'm going to do, and you know, and I think I want to drink again, but I'm not really sure, and I'm like hyperventilating, and he says, well, what are you doing right now? I'm like, well, I'm walking down the street talking to you, and I think this truck's going to hit me, too. I can feel it, man. And, you know, and I got all this crazy stuff going on, and like, you know how it is. A spiritual malady is just throwing everything at you because it wants you to look for relief. You know, that's what it really wants you to do. And I'm freaking out, and I'm like, I'm going crazy. And he goes, well, who are you talking to right now? I'm like, I'm talking to you. And he goes, are you sitting or standing? I'm like, I'm standing. I'm leaning up against a pole here, you know, like a little fence thing. He goes, but is all that stuff happening right now? I'm like, well, yeah, I just told you it was. And he said, no, you're missing it. Hold on. But is it happening right this second? Right this second is all that stuff happening. And I said, well, no, of course it's not happening. He said, I'm going to let you in on a little secret, Shannon. This is with 9 days sober, ready to blow my brains out. Everything's not going to be okay. And I'm like, well, I think I picked the wrong sponsor. He said it already is. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous and doing the three sides of the triangle and having a spiritual experience as a result of what you guys have been trying to tell a knucklehead like me to do for years and years, I've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, and I realize that everything's always been okay. I just have a mind that convinces me that it's not. Thank you, guys.